Well, hello, my friends. This is Mark Gladman, also known as Brother Frederick James, your friendly neighborhood monk in Docs. And this is Monk on the Mic, Episode 2, Where Will You Find Christ This Christmas? First of all, a huge thank you for all the messages and comments and emails and shares and reposts and all sorts of stuff. For the podcast generally and episode one specifically, I am so overwhelmed with the messages that I've received, the way that people have said they have been encouraged and affirmed and supported by the words of the last episode. And I just want to say thank you. I didn't go into this podcast expecting anything in particular. I simply just wanted to share some of my thoughts with the world. And so the fact that one person would find some value in it means the world to me. The fact that I've received so many messages that I have regarding the thoughts in that episode, thank you so much for sharing those, and I'm so pleased that you've been able to find value in it. If you haven't caught episode one yet, you can just obviously go to the same place you found this particular episode, and you'll find it there in episode one. What on earth are you doing? Maybe you'll find the value there too. And again, please continue to share. If you want others to feel the love, you're very welcome to share snippets, thoughts, comments, quotes from that, or for any of the other work that I do online. Speaking of which, the other thing I wanted to let you know too is that the Table app is on the way, as you can hear. My congestion has come down. I'm not coughing or holding back a cough every third word now. I've yet to take another test just to see if there's any traces of COVID left in my system. I'm praying that it's not the case and I can sort of move on with a little bit more normality. But it has slowed down these last things in getting the Table app ready, but it will be going up in the next couple of weeks, once I can get these final little tweaks done. I've decided that I'm going to release the web-based version immediately, and then after it's been approved by Apple and Google, I'll let you know when that comes up. What that means is that whether you choose to download the app from Google or from Apple later on or not, anything that you do with the Table app will be saved inside your account. So that when you do download the app from Apple or Google, you'll be able to simply sign in with your login and you will have everything that you would have used and your progress and whatever it is there, exactly the same as you would any other place you use it. And that's the truth anytime. If you decide to use the web-based version on your laptop, for instance, and then use your Apple one on your iPhone, or you use your Google one on your Google TV or tablet or whatever you choose to do, your sign in and login means that all your access will be kept the same right across all platforms. So I think that's the best way to get it out quickly and make sure people can start to use it. I really do want to get it in your, I was going to say get it in your hands, but maybe it's more get it in your devices. So the best way to make sure that you don't miss out on the release of that is to join the update mail list. You will find the link to do that inside my link tree. So if you go to linktr.ee forward slash monk in docs, and you'll see the Table app update email list there, sign on to that and you will definitely get an email in your inbox saying that everything is ready to go. I will be also doing an announcement on Facebook and Instagram and on Instagram stories. So if you do follow me on Instagram and want to get the information from there, make sure you check the stories because I know the algorithm doesn't always get the daily post up on everybody at the same time. And Facebook, I don't know how it works. So, it might be best if you sign up for the email, and that way you'll get an email in your inbox the very day that is released and you'll have first dibs to get in. And I do pray that you'll find great joy in that. So, without further ado, episode two, where will you find Christ this Christmas? Of course, Christmas is coming up at the end of this week, and everyone's excited about it. My wife, particularly, is a great Christmas person. She's brilliant at the decorations, she's brilliant at you know, making everything beautiful and hosting people and celebrating the truth in Christmas. And I love her for that. It's a beautiful joy that she brings to our household and family when it comes around Christmas. And I know that's not the case for everybody, and that makes me a little sad to think that there are some for whom Christmas can be difficult. And if that's you, and if there's any way I can help, I don't know what that would be, but please don't hesitate to reach out if I can be of support in some way, shape, or form in that sense. But every Christmas, of course, people tell the story. You see it at, you know, kiddie pageants in kindergartens and primary schools. You see it performed in churches. You see it performed on television, on plays. You see it in, you know, the big carols, services, and so on. And so this story gets told about Christmas and how Christmas came about and the whole rigmarole when you got the tea towels on the heads and you got Mary and Joseph on donkeys and innkeepers and all sorts of stuff. And it's interesting, if you sit down and work through the Christmas story as we tell it, as our carols tell it, our songs around Christmas, our hymns even around Christmas, what you find is that the Christmas story that we generally know and celebrate and understand is kind of a hodgepodge clicking together of a combination of Matthew's Gospel, chapters 1 and 2, of Luke's Gospel, chapters 1 and 2, and some other bits that have kind of come through tradition. So, for example, three kings come and visit Jesus. Well, no, that's actually from the hymn We Three Kings. There were no kings who came to visit Jesus. Three magi came, and these were kind of religious leaders from the East, leaders in a different religion. They weren't Jewish. They definitely weren't Christian. They were probably Zoroastrians, and they came to worship this Jesus. And there's a this. It's interesting. If you look at these little things around Christmas, there's a very beautiful backstory to Christmas. If you look at who came to visit Jesus, you've got these shepherds who were kind of like poor and smelly, and they've got this horrible job of wandering around with the sheep and caring for someone else's sheep and making sure they're protected, sleeping out with the sheep under the stars and protecting them from wild animals. And yet these were the people who were the first ones to be told and then to come and pay their homage to this Jesus who's born. Then, so you've got these fringe, poor fringe dwellers of society. Then you have these Zoroastrian religious leaders who are of a completely different religion from a completely other culture, and they come and they worship this Jesus. Can you see there's these beautiful parallels to who Jesus is for and what Jesus is about? That's not where I'm going to go today, though. But so we've got these traditions, you know, three wise men and shepherds and watching their flocks by night and all these other things. And we tell this story that this piece together of all these things. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. Please don't hear me saying that, you know, because there was no innkeeper, every time there's an innkeeper in our kids' Christmas pageants, we should come down. No, I'm not saying that at all. I know there are some people at the moment, particularly on social media, who are finding great pleasure in pointing some of these things out, and that's okay. You know, I don't know what their reasons are for that. Some of them just maybe just pointing some things out and being topical on social media. Some of them might be antagonistic. I'm not saying they all are, but. You know, there's nothing wrong with this telling of the story and celebrating this particular story, but I want to start with a different story, and it's still a biblical story, but it's a different start point. So Matthew and Luke both start with Matthew with a genealogy, then followed by the story of the birth. Luke starts with the story of the birth, moves to a genealogy, then back to the story of the birth again. Mark, he doesn't even have a birth story. Mark's story starts about 30 years after the birth story, and John the Baptist walks out of the wilderness and just starts preaching, prepare the way. And then Jesus follows not long after that. But what I find really interesting is the origins narrative in John's gospel. Now, John's gospel is interesting generally, and I probably should do a monk on the mic about John's gospel a little bit later on, and how it's very different to the other three, not just because of, the synoptics versus John, but also because of the way John speaks and what John seems to be opening our eyes to. And there's some incredible reading I've done about this over the last year, and I want to sort of pull it together and do something with it. We might even do something in the Table app, a study with this as well. But John's gospel starts in a very, very interestingly different position and place. Before I get to John's gospel, though, I want to ask you a question. Where do you see God? Now, I'm not suggesting that you would physically see some sort of image, apparition of God, a direct apparition of God. I don't think that God has legs and arms and faces and noses and nostrils and ears and eyes and all sorts of things. We talk about those things when we're referring to God. We use these anthropomorphisms. We give these human traits to God so that we can try and understand what we're talking about when we're talking about God. I mean, if you've sensed that you've heard God before, it probably was not an audible voice. And so the question is when you said to someone, "I think I heard God speak," what are you actually saying? Well, what you're doing is you're taking this idea of hearing and you're applying it to God, God speaking, so that you can try and help someone understand what it is that you experienced. But does God have an actual mouth, and does God actually speak in those sorts of ways? I don't know. I've never heard it. You may have. But generally speaking, this is what these anthropomorphisms are for, that God walked with the first people in the garden in the cool of the day. What, God grew legs and feet and stepped through the garden? Maybe, but probably not. These are images that help us understand what was happening and what that experience of that relationship with God was like between these first people and God. Okay. So when I ask the question, where have you seen God? I guess what I'm asking is where have you experienced God? Now, there's a really, really interesting and I think important verse in the 20th verse of in around verse 18 and 20 of Romans chapter 1. And this is what Paul writes. Paul writes that for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, God's eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. Now that's incredibly powerful, because what it's suggesting is that God has this ability, well, not just God has this ability, because of who God is and what God does and how God creates and how God sustains all things by being in all things and among all things and around all things. Paul is pointing out that we can see, understand, and experience who God is through the creation that God has both made and is a part of. So, where have you seen God? I have had a couple of experiences, particularly after I began meditation and contemplation. I started to become way more mindful of things. I started to see things that I otherwise would have missed. There's a post I did a while ago of a purple flower that was growing up through the cracks in some stairs. And one day, it was at my workplace when I was chaplain at a school, and I walked down the stairs, and this flower was growing through the crack between a brick wall and the concrete stair. And I just stopped, and I literally sat down with that flower for about 20 minutes. And I had all these reflections, contemplations, prayers, moments of seeing this beauty. Perhaps analogies of what it might be saying about life and what I was working through at that point in time. And it was just beautiful. And I would say to you that I experienced a moment with God in that moment through that flower, that I saw God and had a revelation of God in that flower. Often when I ask young people, particularly this question, where I was working, I worked in a school that was on the coast, and I would have a lot of young people who were surfers talk about, you know, being out the back on their board at sunrise, sitting on their surfboards as the sun just emerges over the edge of the horizon with the cool water lapping at their legs, not a sound at all except the water and the birds that flew over from time to time. And they would say that I just have this spiritual experience every time I'm out there like that. And I won't go on about it because you've no doubt have had experiences like this. I can think of trail runs where I've watched the sun go down and the trails start getting dark. And as the different sounds and the light changed the forest around me, I just had this beautiful experience. And there's probably even places that you go, which you could call chapels or cathedrals, where you are outside in nature or a part of nature. Or maybe it's not outside and in nature. Maybe it's in the face of a baby you've held, or maybe in an encounter with an older person, or maybe it was through the action that you did or someone else did. So all of these things, we can have revelations of God and experiences and encounters with God in all those things. So this is something that Paul writes about. And every time I share this, people say, oh, I've experienced this. I've had this experience myself. Of course you have, in some way, shape or form. So what's this got to do with John's gospel? Well, John's origin story is interesting because John's story doesn't start with the narrative. It doesn't start with the conception. It doesn't start with a genealogy even. John's gospel starts right back. And when you, if you do want to say origin story, John's is the original origin story. Because John starts with this word, and we'll talk about this in just a second, with this word, or in Greek, it's logos. And John writes at the very start of John's gospel, in the beginning was the word, the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God. They were with God in the beginning, and through them all things were made. Without them nothing was made that has been made. In them was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. So right at the very beginning, you have this logos. And this logos is life, and this logos is light. Nothing has been made that hasn't been made by this logos. And the light of this logos shines in the darkness. Now, this word logos, that's translated as word in the English translations of John's gospel. Logos is a really interesting philosophical concept that was around at the time that John wrote his gospel. In fact, it had been around for quite some time. There is some writing by a philosopher by the name of Philo, or Philo, depending on how you pronounce that, who wrote about the logos. And so the early philosophers had this idea of logos, and this is what it meant. The logos was the source of freedom, the supreme genus of everything that was born. So the philosophers had this thing called logos, and the logos was literally the foundation of everything that is, and was also the source of all freedom. All right. And so what John does is, in trying to write about who this Christ is, and in particular who this Jesus is in bearing the Christ, the Spirit of God, John in trying to help us understand where that comes from, says this logos is literally this spirit, this Christ. So John is taking this concept of logos and he's applying it to God. And so John locates or relates this logos to the power, or in Hebrew, the barah, that is behind everything. This word barah in Hebrew that we find in the Genesis chapter 1 poem. This power, this force, this energy that is behind everything. So what John is describing here in the origins of this Christ go right back before Genesis 1. And that what we see here is this Christ is the essence, the substance, the power of all things that have ever been made. And then, after talking about John for a while and how John would be the one who would speak of who this this logos, this word was, he says this in verse 14, and the logos became flesh and made the dwelling among us. I love Eugene Peterson's translation of that, where Eugene writes, the word became human and moved into the neighborhood. How cool is that? And that's literally what happened here. That this force, this power, this energy, this bara that's behind the universe, the essence, the substance, the force, the power of all things that are. If I can go back to the hymn that Paul records in Colossians chapter 1. In speaking of the Christ, Paul writes, and some people believe that what Paul wrote here was not Paul's words, that this was a poem or a hymn that Paul was quoting, that the Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn born over all creation. For by them all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by them and for them. Christ is before all things, and in them all things hold together. There's this beautiful essence of who this is, and that idea of the Christ holding all things together. And a little bit later on, God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in the Christ and through them to reconcile to God all things. So there's this reconciliation, not just a holding of all things together, but a drawing of all things together under God by this Christ, this word, this logos. And this logos becomes flesh. And this is the incarnation of God that we see in the person of Jesus. And if we read on just a little bit from that point, we see in verse 18, no one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made this Christ known. In essence, we have God living in and through this human. And so the Christmas story, when you look at this, in Matthew and Luke, the image of this Christmas story is that this God becomes this baby who grows into this human in order to have this particular mission or passion on their life played out. And so the emphasis from Matthew and Luke seems to be more with this Christ, this Logos being born and becoming human, and then enacting this particular mission. John's gospel takes a slightly different angle because John's focus is on what happens in between those things. Now, I'm not saying Matthew and Luke downplay the earthly ministry of Jesus, and I'm not saying that John downplays the passion narrative. Please don't hear me saying that. What I'm saying is that right from the very get-go, right from the very start, John doesn't talk about this Christ as fulfilling some prophecy. He doesn't talk about this Jesus as being the result of a promise. He literally talks about this Logos, this word, this Christ, being the true essence of who God is, and then that this God, this Christ, this essence, this Logos, moves into the neighborhood as a human being and begins to live in a particular way. What we see happening here is that this human who has been born as the Christ, the fleshly Christ, the incarnation of God, has come to show us how we can truly live into the God image that we have in our lives. And when you think about that and relate it to Christmas, oh my goodness, it really does put a new slant on Christmas. Not to change the focus of what Christmas is and what Christmas is meant to be about, but about what it means. What do we take from Christmas? Oh, this Christ has come and has been born that we may be redeemed. Maybe. But what if the Christmas story is that this Christ has come and has been born to show us how we can live into the fullness of the image of God that's been planted within every single one of us? Now that isn't just something that we have this promise that we're waiting for. This is something that is moving through our lives right as we celebrate Christmas. In the book of Hebrews, in the very first chapter, in the first couple of verses, this is what the writer of Hebrews writes. In the past, God spoke to our forebears through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by Christ, whom God appointed heir of all things and through whom God made the universe. This Christ is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of God's being, sustaining all things by God's powerful word. Whoa. So what we see in Jesus is the exact representation of God's being. The words that are used there in the Greek literally mean icon. That we see as we reflect on Jesus who God is. And this emphasizes, I think, the importance of what is the bulk of the narrative that we have of the life of Jesus, that ministry that of that 3 years where Jesus taught and lived and shared and loved and lived as a human among us. Because when we see Jesus in these interactions with people, when we see Jesus teaching, when we see Jesus responding to people, what we see is the exact likeness of God represented right there. I love the way Richard Rohr puts this. Richard Rohr writes, "In Jesus, God was given a face and a heart. God became someone we could love." It's very hard to love an idea. And I understand why God gave the Hebrew people from very early on a command not to make graven images, because as soon as we do that, we limit who God is and what God can be. If you want to put an equivalent in our modern world, it's the anthropomorphisms that we use to describe God. It literally cheapens, I think, who God is and what God can be about. So I can understand why God wouldn't want any graven images made of them, whether that be a statue or an icon in the form of who God is, not who Jesus was, but God is, whether it be even in the way that we describe who God is and the words we use to describe who God is. But suddenly what we have here in Jesus is a limitless, boundless enacting of who God is. And as I said, furthermore, living the essence of what it means to have God's life come alive in us, to have the Spirit of God that is breathed into every single one of us, the Spirit that animates us. You know, there's a reason why we're meant to live in a particular way, and I don't think we fully embrace that because we don't understand it and comprehend it. And yet in Jesus, what we see is this beautiful love and life of God lived out, because Jesus was the perfect example of what it looks like when we allow God's Spirit to truly live through us. One of my favorite books, if you've read my posts for some time, one of my favorite books in the Bible is 1 John. And one of the things that's coming up in the table up is a complete step-by-step minutiae walk through 1 John, which I think is the letter of love. But at the very, very start of 1 John, let me read to you what John writes here. Obviously, many people believe this is the same John as the John who wrote the gospel that we just talked about. And what we see here at the beginning of John's, the first letter, is these words: that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at with our hands and touched, this we proclaim concerning the logos of life. The life appeared, and we have seen it, and we testify to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And so John is describing here how we experience God and how we experience this Spirit of Christ. And you think about the words that you see here, the verbs that you see here. We've got seen, we've got heard, we've got looked at, we've got touched, we've got appeared. And again, we've got seen and appeared and seen and heard all over again. This is an experience with God that is tangible. And if this experience with God is tangible, it just adds so much more weight to this important concept that it is the life of Jesus which shows us this tangible experience of God living with and through us, and then gives us the primer on how we can start to live that same experience out as well. This is a Christmas story that has so much weight on it, so much importance in it, because it's a Christmas story that affects you right now, today. This is a Christmas story that isn't just this thing that happened in history, and so we celebrate it because it enabled this other thing that happened in history to happen. This is a Christmas story that literally talks to you about how do I live. And so when we sing songs about peace and goodwill to all people, that happens because the Spirit, the Logos of God, lives through you, resides with you, is present in you, has been breathed into you. That this God and this kingdom of who this God is among you and within you and around you and at hand. That this is not, this incarnation is not just something that happened at a point in history through one particular human being. This incarnation happens around you every single day. You see it in the flower. You see it in the sunrise. You see it in the actions of love that come from a friend. But you also see it happening within you and through you when peace comes to your heart. At those moments when you feel absolutely broken, when love somehow finds a crack in the facade that you've put up and allows the light of this love to peep through into your soul and give you some hope. These are all images of this incarnation, this Christ becoming flesh, becoming tangible, becoming seen and heard and known through all of these things, through this creation through which nothing was made that hasn't been made, that's been made, however the riddle goes, through this Christ who is sustains all things and holds all things together and reconciles all things to God. This is the essence of the Christmas story. This is why holding the hand of someone at Christmas is so important. This is why sharing a meal with people at Christmas is so important. This is why the giving of gifts and sharing of love and stories and reconciling with one another and looking out for our neighbor. This is why these things are so important at Christmas. Not that we limit them to Christmas, but they're an important reminder of what this incarnation of God is doing in us, is doing around us, and wants to do among us. In 1 John again, chapter 4, and verse 12, oh boy, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and God's love is made complete in us. Where will you experience Christ this Christmas? My prayer is that at the very least, you experience that indwelling peace and presence of God that has given you life. My prayer is that you also get to experience this by looking around you and seeing the Spirit of the Christ permeating through creation, through nature, through your senses, that you experience what it's like to touch God when you hold your friend, that you experience what it's like to taste God, when you put that food into your mouth, that you experience what it's like to hear God when that beautiful song comes out of your stereo on Christmas Day. My prayer is that this will be a revelation to you this Christmas, of not just this story that means so much to so many people, but one that has an absolute tangible effect on your life today, both towards you from God and from others, but also through you from God and from you towards God and towards others. Where will you see Christ this Christmas? At the very least, I pray that when you look in the mirror, you will see Christ, the presence of the living God dwelling in you, incarnate in and through you. And that, my friends, is where I pray you would see and experience Christ this Christmas. And may the grace, the peace, the joy, and the love of Christmas be with you today and every day. Peace be with you, my friend. Merry Christmas.